Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnar Blog. James, good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Welcome to the season finale of football. That's how it feels a little bit today. The most insane, surreal day in a long time.
Yeah. How do you, like, genuinely... like your gut feeling right now? I mean, I feel really disheartened, disenfranchised, disappointed with what's happened over the last couple of days, or last few hours, I should say. It's quite a visceral reaction, I think. We're not talking about the Fulham game, and we're not talking about Jose Mourinho being sacked, by the way, either. I mean, the European...
No, I found it difficult to get too excited about the Fulham game yesterday, before all this, do you know what I mean? Now it feels almost absurd. We will talk about it, I'm sure, but I think I feel a little bit numb, actually, I have to say. I've been through a lot of different emotions already. You know, there's been shock and anger and disappointment, and I think a little bit of a sense of betrayal. Now I feel slightly detached. I feel like I'm watching a bit of a circus unfold before my eyes, and I guess I don't feel hugely part of it. You know, it feels... football, I think, has been kind of slipping out of my hands as a fan for quite a long time, and it just feels like I've slightly let go of my grip on it in the last 12 hours. Which is helpful in a way, because it enables me to kind of slightly step back and be analytical, but also my detachment, I think, speaks volumes, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, we should be excited. We have a European semi-final coming up. This is a football club which, despite its long and storied history, doesn't have a great record in European competitions and winning European finals. And this, regardless of how the rest of our season has gone, and nobody's saying that it was good or anything like that, you know, you're three games away from winning a European trophy, which is one of the best things that you can do as a football club. We haven't done it anywhere near enough, and it, you know, now you're sort of thinking, well, what's the point?
Yeah, what I mean, there was a rumour, I think, you know, incorrect last night, that they pulled the European competitions. And I consider that unlikely, but when I saw it, I just sort of shrugged. You know, so what? It really does feel like, so what? And I think, actually, that is one of my overriding feelings, I guess, from a personal point of view, is that watching Arsenal this season has been a bit of a slog, and it's required quite a lot of investment, and it genuinely feels like a lot of that investment has been pointless. It does feel like we've kind of invested in and followed this slight charade of a season that ultimately means nothing.
Listen,
that may feel strong, I mean is that it's always had the sort of slight sort of surreal sense of meaning nothing, given the absence of fans and given everything else. But as fans, you know, we have really, you know, done our best to engage with it. And I genuinely do feel a bit like Well, what was the point?
Well, I mean, you know, I have to wonder what it's like for the players and for the manager and what have you as well. I know that our reaction as fans is something we're going to talk about. And look, everyone has their own opinion of what's happening at the club right now, on the pitch, off the pitch, the job that Mikel Arteta is doing. But I think, you know, if you think he's doing a good job or not doing a good job or somewhere in between, I think most people would say that, you know, at least in terms of what he said and what he wanted to do or wanted to achieve in the job, you could get on board with that to an extent, right? That he wanted to make us a competitive club again. He kept saying that these are not the standards that are expected at Arsenal Football Club. And like, okay, you know, he has produced things which are below the standards that are expected for Arsenal Football Club. But, you know, at least in his mind and his heart, I guess, was the ambition to make things better and to make us competitive again and to improve us and to, you know, hopefully create a team that could, A, as we kept saying, get back into the top four, into the Champions League, and then maybe a team that could compete for the title, etc., etc. I mean, what's the point in any of that if you're going to be part of a closed league with no promotion, no relegation? To win what? To win what exactly? A trophy that doesn't exist yet, that nobody cares about? I mean, they might down the line in 5 years' time, people will be going, oh, well, you know, thank goodness we're the European Super League winners. What a great, you know, thing that was. Maybe, you know. But right now you're thinking, well, what if this means we never get to win another league title? I'm not saying we're close to that. What if this means, and it probably does, that we will never, as a football club, lift the European Cup? You know, those are things that you grow up on, wanting your club to win and to achieve. And, you know, I mentioned it in the blog today. You know, you were there in Paris.
Of course.
And what an occasion it was, even if we lost. And I remember in the stadium, it was so gutting and so painful to lose that game the way that we did. But right at the end, as the final whistle blew, all the Arsenal fans standing, supporting, you know, together, there was like a wave of pride, I guess, went around that stadium to everybody who was there in yellow that night, you know, because there was an appreciation for what we had done and what we had come close to doing. And I know everyone says, oh, you lose a final, what's the fucking point? But there's more to it than that. There is something in the community, the collective experience of football that elevates it to this thing that we invest so much of our time in. And now that's gone for what? So we can play twice a season against, you know, for what?
For what? For money.
Yeah, for money, yeah, for money.
Let's be absolutely clear. I mean, that's all this is about. That is all this is about.
I mean, look, I'm going to try not play devil's advocate, but is this not a progression of just what we have experienced in the last 20, 25 years of football anyway? Yeah. That, like, you know, some will say this is like the foundation of the Premier League in a sense, and that it was inevitable. I mean,
I think they're points on a chart, aren't they? You know, there's a relationship. There's a lot about the Premier League. I mean, there was a lot of resistance to the Premier League, and the Premier League was born out of the idea of five clubs, essentially, in 92 or whatever it was, or slightly earlier than that. And they pushed that through, of course. And that was, again, about kind of, you know, redistribution of revenue instead of it going to the entire Football League. You know, the Premier League took the lion's share. The difference, of course, with the Premier League is that it managed to just about preserve the idea of competition, you know, by having promotion and relegation in a traditional sense. They provided a meritocracy of sorts that enabled clubs to aspire to and reach that platform. And granted, it was skewed in the favour of, you know, certain big clubs. But I think you're right. This there is a relationship, and football has been going this way. It, you know, today feels for many people like the straw that broke the camel's back. But let me tell you, that camel ain't been looking too healthy for a period of time. And it's interesting, though. This is kind of a really clear sort of tipping point for a lot of people. I think a lot of what we feel about our detachment from our club and from our game has really come home to roost this morning. And, you know, I kind of have this feeling of this, to me, was probably inevitable. You know, I think we've been talking about it for years and years. And I also have this slight kind of sick, queasy feeling in my stomach of, and I look around at Arsenal and I'm like, this has been coming. You know, we play in the Emirates Stadium. Yeah. I kind of have, you know what I mean? Like, I know it's not the same, it's but
the,
like,
the cognitive dissonance to an extent.
Yeah, we've all been able to kind of play that game of being like, well, we love the sport and we love the players and we love the coaches. And actually, I think that will probably endure. Ultimately, people like watching this game. They like investing in these personalities. Probably that will endure. But there's so much around that that we've had to kind of cover our ears to or cover our eyes to, you know, see no evil, hear no evil. And it's very, very difficult to do that this morning. Yeah. Maybe impossible.
It is, because it's just so cynical, the timing of it as well. And I think what's happened during the pandemic and the losses that clubs have sustained has perhaps brought this forward a bit, you know?
Oh, definitely. There's no doubt. COVID has provided the perfect opportunity in some ways.
Even just fucking... I know what you mean when you say that.
Listen.
But, you know, I know... I know exactly what you mean when you say that, but when you say it out loud and when you consider, you know, the realities of, you know, people can say COVID, but delve into it, the reality of what this thing is and what it has done to societies, to people,
of course,
to
millions of deaths,
families and all of those things, for these fuckers to come along right now and use that to sort of put this land grab in fucking motion, it's really, really annoying.
Yeah. Well, it's a power grab. It's a money grab. And the reason I say that, by the way, apologies to anyone who's sort of offended by that.
No,
it's
not
something I subscribe to, but it's definitely true. I think it's true from their perspective. They feel that, you know, A, they've got the financial losses, which obviously they don't like, but I think also... I don't know. I think in some ways it suits them to not be doing this at a time when there are fans in stadiums. I mean, maybe they wouldn't give a shit either way, but you avoid protest effectively. You avoid, you know, a lot of the issues that might be created around that very visible resistance from fans on the ground. I also think that probably, unfortunately, the absence of fans from stadiums and the relative success, probably in ratings terms, of football in that period has perhaps even enforced the idea that, well, if our, you know, traditional supporters don't like this, fuck them.
Well, I mean, did you see the...
Legacy fans.
Yeah, from Dan Roan at the BBC. He says, according to a source, some of those involved in the European Super League call traditional supporters of clubs legacy fans, while they are focused instead on the fans of the future who want superstar names.
Well, maybe they will be legacy fans soon. Because that, well, I mean, I've heard a lot, anecdotally, I know of plenty of people who say, this is it for me.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've heard that and I've read that plenty of times and I've seen it on my timeline. And we've so many comments on the website today, on the news articles about people saying, well, that's it. You know, if this is what it is, then that's enough for me. And that's maybe a discussion we can have.
There's lots of questions about that. But the club have treated their supporters with contempt in this instance, in my belief. The statement that they put out with no quotes from anybody senior at the club, but a quote from one of the Glazers, and, you know, the sort of sickening stuff that we're getting out of Juventus and Real Madrid about being the guardians of the game and wanting what's best for fans.
No, I mean, that tweet last night, it was like, I don't know what, it was like being punched in the stomach seeing that tweet last night, because I know that there are people, you know, at the football club who are working there, who are, you know, who will feel the same way that we feel about this. You know?
Of course.
Whose job it was last night to prepare and put out that statement, which would be at odds completely with what they think about their football club, because it's their football club as much as it's our football club, you know? And they understand what Arsenal is and what it should be and what we all want it to be. And that statement last night was, I mean, if anything highlights the disdain, and I don't use that word lightly, because it's not about indifference or it's not about not caring. For Arsenal Football Club to put out a statement like that, and the edict comes from on high, it comes from the owners, it comes from Stan, it comes from Josh, it comes from KSE, to put out a statement on this issue on our official website with not a single word from them about what it means, how fans might react to it, how fans might feel about it, and instead to have a quote from the co-chairman of another football club, of Manchester United, and I'm sure Manchester United fans this morning are feeling as sick about this as we are, right? So I'm not gonna talk about, you know, issues between Arsenal and Manchester United, because weirdly this might sort of bring the fan bases a little bit closer together in some ways. But, you know, it's just so disrespectful and disdainful of Arsenal fans to put that out last night. It's just disgraceful.
It is. That's the exact word I was going to use. It is a disgrace. I think you can make a cold-blooded, rational case for a sort of business logic to why this is happening.
Mm.
But I think for that statement to go out without anything from anybody at the club attached to it is shameful. I think it's embarrassing.
Mm.
I think it is absolutely a disgrace. And I include the owners in that, of course. I also think we've got a chief executive. You know, why is there nothing from Vinay on that? I think it's an appalling oversight to not communicate with your supporters about this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this entire Super League is sort of founded on the bullshit premise that supporters want it. And I guess maybe what we'll discover is that certain supporters do. You know, and maybe there is a split. Maybe there is a kind of traditional fan and a new fan, and maybe there is a disparity between what those supporters want. But look, what we're seeing is that clearly it's not a unified position, and there has been no consultation. You know, there has been no engagement with fans on this matter. But I can't get away from the fact that not having the balls, basically, to step out in front of it and explain it or justify it or own up to it, essentially, admit it or own the decision.
Cowardly as well, isn't it? It is absolutely cowardly to just hide behind the words of another football executive to put out this blanket statement. I mean, they knew and they must have known how it would go down. I mean, I'm not saying
what the joke is. I bet the first person who has to answer a fucking question on it is Mikel Arteta.
Yeah, probably. Probably. I mean, what, you know, I was thinking about this morning. I was thinking about, you know, someone like Jurgen Klopp, who I think has
very much on record as not being behind this sort of idea.
You know, I don't quite know what Mikel Arteta thinks about this sort of thing. Whether there's a sort of egalitarian side to his personality. But I think we know with Jurgen Klopp that there has been an awareness, or certainly he's demonstrated that, you know, he understands the fan experience and you know, he spoke about various issues and came down on them, I think, on the right side, you know, on a societal level, on a personal level. I think he's taken the right point of view on certain issues. So if he looks at this and sees Liverpool fans going crazy about it, who hate the idea of it, who, you know, think about how many European Cups of Liverpool won? 5? 6? I mean, how have they voted? How have they decided to just obliterate their own history in a competition for this? I mean, it must be sickening, right? So, like, what does Jurgen Klopp do if he has a massive objection to this? Or Mikel Arteta do if they have a massive objection to this? When their owners, Stan Kroenke, vice chairman, John Henry, vice chairman of this idea, this abomination of a reality TV show, right? If they object to it publicly, it puts them completely at odds with the people who own the club. So they either compromise their integrity completely or they get sacked.
Yeah, that will be an interesting one from Klopp. It will be really interesting. Particularly Liverpool's a particular case study because it is a club with such a sort of rich socialist history and support.
Yeah, yeah.
This will be incredibly badly received there. I mean, I think we need to try to structure this conversation because I know that one question people have is this legit? Is this real? Is this actually happening or is this a play? And so I just wanted to ask you, like, what do you think about that?
I mean, there's part of me that thinks, yeah, it's a kind of... They're putting it up to them to see what they can get. I'm not quite sure what it is they want, you know? But, I mean, we've quit the European Club Association.
Yeah, I mean, a tell for me. I thought this was a negotiating tactic, as it has been in the past, right up until about 10 o'clock last night, when it became clear that... You know, they were going to announce and people were, I think Juve were the first to kind of step down from the ECA. And that, that's burning some bridges.
Well,
you know,
it is.
Some bridges have really, really been burnt by this.
Particularly given that Vinay was only elected to the European Club Association on the 8th of March, 2021.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's just over a month ago.
Nice little statement from the club at the time about how delighted they were to see him elected.
Yeah, hang on. What was the great quote here? Bum, bum, bum. Let me see here. The European Club Association is central to helping shape the future of the game with UEFA and FIFA. And Agnelli said, this is the guy at Juventus, he said, there are too many games that are not competitive, both at a domestic and international level. Imagine saying that before you float the idea of a league which is completely uncompetitive.
It does beg a belief, to be honest. So I think this is 100% real.
So do I.
I think that the only thing I think that's likely to stop it is government involvement. And I think I do hold out a fair bit of hope for that, actually, because the UK government have wanted to regulate football for a long time.
But is that not a dangerous road to go down, that football is regulated by government? I mean...
That is problematic, but I sense that the government will... try to take the opportunity and with the groundswell of kind of opposition among supporters to enact that. And let's be very clear, that has its problems too. And another thing to say is, one thing that we haven't said is there's kind of no good guys in this. You know, I have not a great deal of time for Sky Sports or the Premier League or UEFA kind of... getting out their violins, because those guys have played as big a part in football spiralling out of supporters' control as any other.
For sure, yeah. I mean, there's an element of hypocrisy to it. I watched Gary Neville speak last night on Sky Sports and I thought he was great. I thought
he's speaking as a footballer. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, but also he's speaking, you know, using the platform of Sky Sports, which isn't quite the same thing. You know, it was, you know, it's... It's not quite the same as what's happening here. I mean, they're using the rights of football, you know, obviously to make money, but it's not quite as destructive as what this is.
No, I mean, ultimately they are paying for those rights.
Yeah,
you know what
exactly.
I mean? So that, and that's what this is all about, by the way. Why is the Super League happening? it is about creating, in their minds, a superior TV product. That's what this is. Mm. It's, and you know, it will get picked up by Netflix or Amazon, one of the big streaming services, I suspect, and they'll basically think we've got endless seasons of premium content. And that is football finally repackaged into just pure content, I think.
Yeah, no pretense whatsoever.
No.
But where is, and, you know... Look, you know, I don't think there's anything good about a sporting competition that has no competition or no real sporting merits, that's only there for the benefit of TV audiences and to sell subscriptions and all that kind of stuff. You know, what makes football great and what makes sport great is the element of chaos, I guess, or the idea that something can happen that nobody expects. You know,
of course, you know, Leicester winning the Premier League and it's the one that always gets cited, but quite rightly so. It was quite extraordinary. And while there's already a financial disparity between these big six clubs and some others in the Premier League, of course, that gap's going to get wider. I also just think inevitably, because another thing some people have had say to me is, you know, well, we're already in European competition and we play that in midweek anyway. So how different really is this going to make things? Very different is my answer.
What? Why? I mean, I kind of know why, but do you want to expand on that? But
well, I think there are loads of reasons, to be honest. I think the first is that with the increased amount of fixtures in Europe, I think it's inevitable that that becomes more of the focus than the domestic league, which obviously just changes the dynamics of supporting your football club. I think it has a huge impact on that domestic league. You know, if the Premier competition becomes the Super League, but the Premier League is not able to offer you qualification to that, essentially, then what does it matter if you come third or fifth or seventh, or as Arsenal currently are, ninth? It sort of ceases to have any real consequence.
Yeah. I mean, the ludicrousness of Arsenal in ninth being part of a European Super League, the ludicrousness of Tottenham, who haven't won a league title, and this isn't just because, you know, it's a cheap, easy shot at Tottenham, although it is at the same time. You know, they haven't won a league title since 1961. They haven't won a major trophy since when? When was the last time Tottenham won the FA Cup? You know, this is supposedly, you know, the Super League, you know. It is.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think it's quite embarrassing where we are in the league. And my overriding feeling on this, and I've been asked to write about this, so you will hear this line from me elsewhere, so apologies, but I think that the Super League is basically a get-out-of-jail-free card for a poorly run club. That's what it is.
Mm. Well, yeah, it's good for us in that sense. You know?
Yeah, because we've been making an absolute shambles of it, and somehow we are part of this. And you know, we are a big club. We know that much, but we haven't performed.
How do we marry the statement from the Super League, who say, yeah, we're going to do it. It's going to be great. It's going to be midweek. But, you know, we won't shirk our responsibilities to the domestic leagues. You know, we're still going to play in the domestic leagues, blah, blah, blah. When UEFA and the Premier League, et cetera, are saying, no, you can't do this. How does that get resolved? How is there resolution there? Is this where the bargaining side of things comes in? Because they put it up quite strongly, you know, and like I said, we've withdrawn from the European Club Association, you know, which is basically a two fingers to UEFA. So how does that get resolved? I mean, the Premier League can say, well, no, we don't want you, but a Premier League without United, without Arsenal, without Liverpool, without City, you know, without Chelsea.
They won't
you know,
say that, will they?
No, they can't.
I don't think they can't. Can.
Because, like, how do you sell subscriptions with the, you know, with the greatest of respect to the other clubs? And I'm not saying we're a shining star or anything like it, but there is a, you know, there's a there's a fan base with these clubs that generates the subscriptions and the interest and all of that kind of stuff because of the size, because of the stature of the clubs. You know, a Premier League Super Sunday, which consists of Burnley against West Brom, and, you know, it's not going, it's, you know, the product is immediately diminished. And I don't mean that to sound disrespectful to the other clubs in any way. I don't, because we're all part of the league. And, you know, as we Arsenal fans have discovered this season, you know, your stature means basically fuck all when it comes to what happens on the pitch, considering some of the results that we've had. So I'm not taking anything for granted and saying these meager small clubs, but the reality is that, you know, in marketing terms, in sponsorship terms, in brand terms, and all of that kind of stuff, you know, these European Super League adjacent clubs would be a massive miss for the Premier League. So how does that get resolved?
Well, I think that's sort of the gamble these six clubs have taken, that they feel the Premier League is kind of reliant on them and that they won't be forcibly ejected. I think from a kind of ethical point of view, you couldn't have any qualms with it if the Premier League were able to take that stand. I think if Arsenal got booted out of the Premier League for this, I think they would sort of deserve it. But I don't think that's realistic. And I think, I don't know how that gets resolved. Probably financially is the sort of sad answer to that. If they have to smooth that over, it will probably be in terms of money. But that sort of raises an interesting point. You know, we're speaking about this as Arsenal fans. I cannot imagine the hatred and contempt I would feel for these clubs and this sort of falsified division if I was a supporter of one of the other Premier League
teams. If we hate it, why wouldn't they hate it? There's this sort of arrogance and hubris to the whole thing that, like, somehow, look, the histories and the statures of the club are in many ways, for a lot of clubs anyway, predicated on success and traditional success. And Liverpool are a big club because they were a brilliant club and won the title lots of times. And Manchester United, you know, have their stature and have had it for years and years and years. And Arsenal, you know, maybe we're not at that level, but, you know, we've had success down the years and we've been considered a big club because of that. We have our stature because of our reputation. There are other clubs, you know, who have, whether you like it or not, bought their way into it. Man City have bought their way into it. Chelsea have bought their way into it, you know. But if we hate this,
yeah,
why the fuck wouldn't the others? I mean, even that statement where they capitalized founding clubs, this kind of bullshit God complex nonsense that they've got, it is just, it's despicable, it's deplorable, and I hate every single thing about it. And I'm really sad that regardless of what happens, whether this comes to pass or not, or whether it's a tweaked version or some kind of monstrosity that sort of morphs itself into existence down the line, I'm so sad that what Arsenal have done will never be able to be undone, because it's left a stain on the relationship between the club and the fans. And that's on the owners. Like, I love my club, I support my club. But it's hard not to really despair that as an institution it has behaved in a way which is completely and utterly at odds with what we all hope. Maybe it's an idealized version of what we think Arsenal is as an institution. But I think the widespread, vociferous response to that tweet that Arsenal put out last night tells you that for a lot of us, whether we're right or wrong, but in our hearts, our hope or what we expect from our football club, they fell way below those standards last night with this.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, you know, the so-called big clubs have been trying to protect their own interests in football for a long time. It's actually one of the reasons I've always been sort of opposed to FFP because I think that was just a way of trying to shut the door once, you know, they'd kind of got to the top table. And I think, you know, this is obviously a really extreme version of that. Fundamentally, it's the lack of competition element that worries me most. The idea of kind of permanent residence in this Super League. You know, if we think Arsenal are sort of uninspiring and average and underachieving now in the Premier League, imagine what they might be without the threat of relegation.
Well, I mean, at least, you know, the other thing you might say is, you know, if we like cling to some hope that our owners are not complete monsters, and I think that's gone now. You know, it's the idea that, well, at least there's some connection between financial success and sporting success as it stands, right? So you get back into the Champions League, you get more money.
Of course,
yeah. And the two things can be sort of symbiotic, right?
It's a motivating factor.
So if the Cronkies want to make more money, make the club more successful. But if you're in this thing where it doesn't really matter where you finish from 15th to 1st, there might be some element of prize money, but you're sustained by just the existence.
Your revenues are guaranteed to an extent. So there's less of a motivating factor. There's less of an impetus. I mean, I suppose the sort of the reality is that those revenues mean, I don't know what they fucking mean, but I guess it gets to the point where these clubs probably, if this happens, probably have almost two squads. They can probably afford it. And it means that they are able to compete on multiple fronts. But it's such a distortion of domestic competition at that point that it's sort of very difficult to invest in it emotionally. Yeah, it's a really sad day. And I think when you speak about the club sort of acting in a way that has, you know, shown a bit of a contempt for fans, I think really it's a lack of respect for tradition, and that's been going on for a long time. But, you know, the historical values of Arsenal are completely absent at this point. I mean, the absurdity of, you know, laying off Gunnosaurus. I know it's a kind of symbolic thing, but then having this check coming in down the line, it is pretty sickening.
Yeah, I mean, with a question here, I might as well just do it now from Twitter, from Alex, who's at AlexCullen17. And I realise this is a very niche part of the conversation, but he says, it's easy for fans like myself to talk about cutting ties with the club after the Super League announcement. But how do you and James feel about this as two people whose job revolves around the club as well as being fans? And, you know, like I said, I know it's very niche, but I think that the overall point is that, you know, you can be, it's easy. No, it's not easy. You can say, or you can write, well, that's it for me. That's as much as I can take. I can't participate in this. I don't like this. What your head tells you, but what your heart feels is very different, isn't it? That, like, you can say, this is terrible and cynical and I don't want any part of it, but you can't just switch it off. You can't switch off how you feel about this fucking football club.
No, and some people will, you know, I think there will be a percentage of people who are able to do that, and that's what they want to do. I can't make that promise myself. I think that I'm pretty realistic, actually, about the fact that if this happens, for all the anger now, and although I think the relationship between the club and its supporters may be kind of irrevocably damaged, I believe that people will engage with and watch, for the most part, this new competition.
What happens when fans are back in the stadium? What happens when, you know, there was supposed to be a fans forum meeting, I think, this week, and that's been postponed for some reason. Like, well, at some point, there's got to be some either face-to-face communication with the club you know, they can't just hide away forever. At some point, they have to to make this public facing. Like, they're in charge of the football club. They've made the decision to do what they've done. They can't just hide until it all goes away. Because, you know, at some point there's got to be, when I say confrontation, I mean, I don't mean like a fist fight or anything like that. But there's got to be a, you know, at some point, the people who are in charge of the club, and I don't mean Mikel Arteta here, because it's wrong, I think, to expect him to be the spokesperson for the executives and the owners. Mm. Like, there's got to be some kind of reckoning in some way, doesn't there?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think you're right. Vin and I were supposed to meet Fans Forum on Sunday night. That was cancelled for very obvious reasons now. They will have to put something out. And I pray to God they do it before Mikel Arteta has to sit in a press conference and attempt to answer questions on this, because frankly, it's not his responsibility. So I really hope, I imagine we'll see, you know, the classic tailored interview, a member of Arsenal staff interviews another member of Arsenal staff and they put across their point of view. I hope we get more than that. I mean, I can imagine the justification that they'll use. I imagine they will say, they'll point to their...
unprecedented times.
Yeah. There'll be a lot of that. There'll be a lot of COVID references. There'll be a lot of pointing to the club's losses and in the previous year and the forthcoming losses that are due to come. And I guess their fundamental argument will be what they've always said, which is that, you know, they didn't, they wouldn't want the train to leave the station, you know, without being on board.
We're better off in it than not in it at all. And if this is the reality, then while it's unpalatable for some people, you know, would we not be better off as part of this? I guess.
Yeah. You know, yeah. And what do you think about that?
I mean,
I don't like it, but I can understand it.
Ich nicht in Lichten. Yeah, I mean, I can understand it as well. I can understand it. And I, you know, there is...
The longer this went on with us underachieving as a football club, you know, if this was happening in 5 years, are we on that list? That, I think, is where it becomes really interesting, because it's like, did Arsenal need this to happen now?
Well... There you go. I mean, there were stories doing the rounds that the Kroenke was one of the main pushers.
That's
for
my
this.
Understanding, yeah.
Yeah,
that they were American looking for this owners thing. And Florentino Perez have kind of, you know, driven the...
I can see why the owners want it. Of course. Here's this guaranteed
obviously.
Income.
I mean,
where is this money coming from? I know there's like
JP Morgan yeah, putting up... 5 billion, you know, underwriting.
Yeah.
The idea then is that these clubs will auction off the TV rights to... they must have an understanding of what kind of figure they would get. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been able to secure the loan that they needed.
Of course, yeah.
But they will have an auction, and that the idea is that effectively that's how this will all be paid for. So, yeah, that's the idea. But what were we saying?
We were talking about why
they
wanted...
The owners.
Like, yeah, like, I mean...
Yeah, of course.
Barcelona with a billion euro debt. Someone comes along and guarantees you 350 million straight away and then X amount every year. I mean, there's a good thread. I'll link to it in the show notes from a guy called James Corbett who... he has done an outline of how the money is distributed, and the 350 million figure, not every club gets that. Even within the 15 founder clubs, not with capitals. You know, there's a disparity between who gets what. The biggest clubs get the most. So even within this structure, there's a sort of, the decks are stacked towards the bigger clubs.
That doesn't surprise me. I mean, It'll be interesting to see what kind of sway Arsenal hold in that situation.
Well, we're not going to be one of the we're not one of the big ones.
No,
that's the reality.
And, you know, we don't have an experienced chief executive who has built up these relationships over a long time.
Raul Sanyehi involved in it, of course.
Yeah, reportedly, yeah.
Which is why he was brought into to Arsenal.
Yeah, and this, you know, I had some interesting conversations yesterday about that, about how in the last 5 years Arsenal have sort of known, well, suspected that this was coming. I mean, everyone's seen the quotes that we did 10 years ago. Arsene Wenger, you know, predicting it. I mean, everyone could kind of predict it. But I think the appointment of Sanyehi was partly to help Arsenal position themselves for this eventuality. Ivan Gazidis was certainly very aware that this was the direction of travel.
He's another one up to his fucking eyes in it as well, isn't he?
Yeah, 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 with Milan. So it has been coming, but it's still, you know, it still feels shocking in some ways to see it unfold as quickly. Also, it feels like it happened very slowly, but also very, very quickly.
Yeah.
In terms of the story escalated.
Yeah, it was just sort of yesterday morning. It was like, oh, fuck, well, that's a bit, yeah, that's not going to be good if that happens. And it's like, that'll never happen. And then it fucking happened. A couple of hours later, it's like, Jesus.
Yeah, of course. And this was all based around UEFA reforming the Champions League. I mean, there are things in the previous system that are kind of broken. I mean, it's their own fault. But Barcelona have got to a point where they cannot survive in La Liga. You know what I mean? Like, they are bloated to the extent, and I think the same is true of Madrid, that, you know, a league that is not hugely internationally strong, they cannot sustain themselves. Arsenal, we are discovering, cannot really sustain themselves right now. So I guess something had to give. Clearly, the incentive for the owners is to have guaranteed revenue. It's it's very similar, isn't it, to the American system, to which many of them are more accustomed. But as a fan, it's just completely uninspiring. And, you know, the classic thing of, will these games feel special when we're watching us lose them with that kind of regularity?
Well, no. They won't.
Well, they will for a bit. You know what I mean? It's like everything. When this starts, there'll be... Sorry, my throat is fucked this week. But there'll be... maybe I'm turning into Raul Sanyehi. What a terrible thing to happen.
No.
But, yeah, inevitably, you know... Do you think I'm wrong about that? I mean, am I being too cynical to think by the time this rolls around, people are subscribed to watch games, they'll engage with it, and
I think
the world
you
will
know,
keep turning.
I kind of think that is what will happen, because it's, like I said, you can't switch it off.
That's the thing. You know, what are our alternatives as fans? Yes, we can make our voices clear. We can make our position clear. I just... You know, as whenever you have these kind of breakaway Phoenix clubs, you know, as many FC United fans as there are, there's a shitload more Man United fans still. You know, people can't divorce themselves of an emotional attachment that they've built up over 30, 40, 50 years to a club.
Yeah.
It's not realistic. And so to go back to the question, which was some time ago now, about what do we feel? What do we do? I mean... We talk and write about the club, and I have to be completely honest and say, increasingly, anything that's not the games, I'm less and less and less interested in it. Like, that's not players, that's not sport. I find talking about, and I'm professionally obliged to do it, but I find talking about boardroom shenanigans and stuff like that fucking dull, and it's not something I'm interested in.
Yeah, I agree.
And I feel like, what happens? What do we do? My prediction is that that's what we'll continue to do, that people will still care about goals and stars and bits of skill and wins and rivalry. I think those things will endure. But I just think that the only way to survive as a fan is to create such a big cognitive dissonance that you almost have to say, I ain't part of that. Like, but I appreciate that's too big. For some people, that's too big a compromise. If you're putting money into the pot, you are part of it.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Complex.
It is. It's just not, like I said, it's not possible just to switch off. As you say, divorce yourself from it. And yeah, I think that's what perhaps the most cynical part of this is that they know that football fans can't, for the most part, some will, I know some will, but for the most part, cannot walk away. They don't want to. It means
they're already
too much to us.
£1,500 for a season ticket or £70 for a replica shirt every fucking season, even though half of them are horrific. And it says visit Rwanda on it. Like, we have shown, unfortunately, football clubs that they can take the piss. And they absolutely have, with kickoff times, with ticket prices. They have learnt that they have got a captive audience.
That's it.
And for every fan who takes a stand and says, I'm not engaging it with it anymore, and I really respect those people, there will be 1,000 who aren't able to do that.
Yeah. Or, and you know, it generates new fans. The
new
legacy fans.
New territories, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, you know, when I talk about a superior TV product, what they're thinking is, does a fan, and I'm going to say China just to pick an example of a big economy the Premier League is interested in, does a fan in China want to watch Burnley, Sheffield United?
But does he want to watch Arsenal, Burnley, or does he want to watch Arsenal, Real Madrid, Arsenal, Barcelona?
Exactly. You know, does he want to watch the teams who are good on FIFA, basically? And maybe that's not true of all fans. Like, I'm sure it's not. I'm sure there are loads of fans abroad, some of them probably listening to this show, who genuinely love the kind of volatility of the English Premier League and the idea that Burnley can beat Man U or Fulham can get a draw with Arsenal or whatever it might be. I'm sure there are plenty of fans. But the mass market is the casual fan. And I suspect their calculation on that is probably right.
Fans of the future.
Yeah. And it's not us. And it's probably not most of the people listening to this, because I think we're so engaged with, you know, the existing structure, the existing format, the existing rivalries. But yeah, it's... I just feel like it's kind of gone beyond. I feel like an old man. That's how I feel. I feel like time, society, and football is sort of moving. I'm only 34, but I feel like it's just moved into something that I don't fully recognise. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. There's this hashtag content thing going on with football and sport and all that kind of stuff. The way that people consume the game, the way that people view the game, the way that people view the people who view the game mm-hmm. is, you know...
And people will different. Continue to consume. That's the thing. And
of course.
I don't know. I in saying that, I feel like, am I too beaten? Am I too defeated? But I think I would say I'm realistic. I know the regard in which I'm held by the owners of these clubs
mm.
as a fan. It's clear to me in everything they do. So,
and yet here we are.
Yeah. I don't expect them to, and yet here we are talking about them. Yeah, mm. but, yeah, mm. it's a really sort of, I don't even know how to start. Like I said at the start,
there's this sort of emptiness, isn't there?
Yeah,
there's
a lot of it feels pointless. I mean, like you talk about the Villarreal game, I honestly couldn't give a fuck. Like, I know we should be talking about Fulham. Maybe we'll talk about Fulham in a bit, but like. Who gives a fuck? Like, it just feels like it doesn't matter. It just feels like it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, if there are people at this football club and, you know, who are listening to this, and even if you're not... Like, this is what it has done. That's what this announcement and this participation in this has done. It's made... you and I and many of the people listening to this who are as passionate about this football club as anyone can be feel like the most important thing about football, the game itself, the matches we're going to play, doesn't matter. What a fucking shocking indictment that is on all of this. And yeah. they should be ashamed of themselves. But they're not.
No, they're not. And they don't care, you know, and I don't even say that asking for them to care. They're not going to care.
Mm.
But, you know, we are the ones who have to live it and experience it. And it. Listen, it's a moving situation as well. I mean, this won't be the last conversation we have about this, unfortunately.
No, probably not. And, you know. Whether it's something we come to terms with or something else, you know, the initial shock of something like this and the initial gut punch of something like this wears off and I guess you adjust your own goalposts accordingly to where you can feel comfortable with everything that's going on, you know?
That's it. And I think, it's just horrible, isn't it? Because you're sort of like, we're the baddies. You know what I mean? We are the baddies in football, and it's uncomfortable. Just a final sort of question: yeah. What do you think the reaction would have been if this news had come out and Arsenal weren't on that list?
Question. I mean, I don't think that would ever have been a consideration. I guess it would just make you really despise everyone who was involved in it. And if there are fans of other clubs out there, you know, and I know there are some who listen to this who really hate Arsenal right now, don't blame them.
It does give you an insight into how fans of other clubs must feel.
I mean, exactly, because they've all been just dismissed as an irrelevance, you know, as not good enough, as second rate, as you know, and look... keep using the example of Burnley, right? Again, it's not to sort of dismiss them or anything like it, but how can Arsenal, sitting ninth in the Premier League, having lost twice to Burnley, look down their noses at football clubs like that?
Yeah.
It's just... Look, will we take a break and we'll talk about some football and stuff in part two?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's do it.
All right. We will take a break. Probably have a shot of something strong. And we'll do your questions and more in part two right after this. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog, also on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. Before we get on with part two, I just want to mention something which I think almost ties in with this European Super League thing. If we're looking at that as a greedy capitalist vultures doing their thing, I want to point you in the direction of a petition to help save the Tollington, which is a pub that you and I know well, James. Martin and Louise are amazing people, have been great friends to Arsblog down the years. We've launched both of our books there. They're being hounded out by, again, venture capitalists who are looking to redevelop the plot. They're trying to kick them out because of arrears in rent. The pub has been more or less closed for the duration of the pandemic. So there's a lot going on there. And if we want to do our best to fucking stick it to that kind of man, there is a petition that you can sign. I know it's probably something or somewhere that very few people listening to this will ever get to, because I know we've got an audience all around the world, but the Tollington have always been open to fans from wherever they've come. You know, people have come there, got tickets from fellow fans, got to see their first games there. So if you can, please do sign the petition wherever you are in the world. It's in the show notes. You'll find it in the show notes. Takes a couple of minutes or a couple of seconds, really, just to sign the petition and confirm your email address. And it will really help our friends at the Tollington if you could manage that. So we'd really appreciate that. It's a difficult situation for them to lose potentially your livelihood, your business, your the jobs for all the people who work there, you know, your home as well. So it would mean a great deal to us if you could sign that petition. It's a tough time for them. So every bit of help is welcome.
Definitely. Please do go and do that. It's a really great pub and one that's had a really good relationship with Arsblog, and there's been a brilliant community there down the years. So
sure has.
It'd be a real shame if anything bad happened.
All right. Football. Do you want to do... You got a football question?
Football. Yes. Jamie Murphy on Twitter says, where do you stand on the Eddie Nketiah celebration? I've seen a lot of hate for him online over it, for not getting the ball and running back to the centre circle.
I mean,
hard to care, isn't it, about this stuff?
I mean, the kid has barely played in, what, months? And he scores a goal in the, what,
97th minute.
I mean, I understand why he celebrated, for goodness sake. I know that you can have the discussion, well, we should just get the ball and run back and, you know, get the second goal, etc. You know, I get it, but like, fuck. You know, sometimes shit happens in the moment, right?
Yeah, and also, like, it's not like we had 5 minutes to score another
goal.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? Time was basically up.
The game was up. And also, it's a big goal for him personally. Like, he's had a really difficult few months, not got any game time. Almost certainly he's looking for a move in the summer. You know, he needs to kind of advertise what he can do. I was pleased for him, to be honest. I was pleased for him to get a goal, because he's sort of been on the fringes and not really had an opportunity.
Well, like, given everything that happened yesterday, I find it difficult to get particularly exercised about that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, me too. And I was the same before all this Super League news as well.
Yeah. I mean, on that, from the Discord, WMD Gunner says, should Arteta have started Eddie or Balogun over Lacazette? We really don't have anything to play for in the league campaign, so why risk Lacazette considering Aubameyang is recovering from malaria? Don't feel particularly strongly about it, but I thought it was an interesting question about the actual game yesterday.
Yeah, it is an interesting question. I mean, Balogun was there. He was with the squad, apparently. I think he must have been the extra man, because I don't think he was on the bench.
No.
I do understand involving Nketiah. I think, you know, what happened yesterday might have put £1 million on his price tag. And, well, I thought we needed that money at the time. Maybe Mikel Arteta did too. Yeah. I don't know how much he knew or not about any of this. I'm sure he was aware. But, yeah, we risked Lacazette and it backfired. I mean, that's a...
It's a three-weeker at least, isn't it?
It looked it. It looked it. It looked another... Yes, another bad injury. I thought as well, Granit Xhaka had got one, I have to say. He looked in a lot of pain.
I mean, yeah, when he stayed down, I was like, oh, shit, because, like, he... whatever else you think about him, he's not that guy. He's not that guy.
That must have been sore. I mean, Lacazette, it looked like a pull at best, you know, a tear at worst. Mm. He knew straight away. And that is a blow. He's been playing well. He's become quite important in the last couple of games, the way we've played. Do I think it was the wrong decision to play him? I mean, Mikel Arteta probably hasn't given up on the idea of rescuing our Premier League position and presumably felt, you know, this was an opportunity to continue the momentum, get 3 points. We don't play again until Friday, which is a relatively big gap at this stage in the season.
Yeah.
We've got another big gap to Villarreal. Well, not a big gap, but, you know, nearly a full week. So I guess he just thought he could get away with it. I wasn't annoyed about it in the starting lineup when it came out, so I'm not going to get too annoyed about it now. I was a little bit surprised not to have Balogun on the bench. I just thought if it was a game we were winning, which wasn't an unrealistic expectation, it might have been a nice opportunity to get him a few minutes. What did you make of it all?
Yeah, I mean, like, he is the senior striker we have at the club right now, and it's, you know, he obviously rested Thomas Partey, I thought.
Which I think had a massive impact on the game.
Oh, my God. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the screenshots, but that moment in the first half, I think it was, fairly early on in the first half, where Elneny goes backwards. You know, we asked Elneny to do... Because we play basically the same system, right?
He was the one-man midfield.
And we asked Elneny to do a job that, like, with the greatest of respect to him, he can't do. Like, if you want someone to, like, keep the ball... circulate possession, you know, run around and make sure that there are 5-6 yard passes being made. He's the guy. He is the guy. But if he's being asked to play the role, and I know Ceballos was in there as well, but, you know, what Partey is capable of doing, Elneny certainly isn't.
No, it's rare that I gasp at a backwards pass.
Oh, I did.
I think I did at that one.
I think I even wrote it out loud in the live blog, if I remember. It's just like,
there were a couple, but I genuinely was astonished. It was like, it was an unusual thing to see on a football pitch in that instance. And I think Elneny, when he's been okay at Arsenal, it's been as a foil for a better footballer. And when you're sort of vacating the middle of the pitch and asking a guy to be a one-man midfield, he is not that guy. And listen, I actually do approve of resting Thomas Partey, given all the injury problems he's had. I think it was right to leave him out.
Yeah, what it shows you is that you need, you know, people talk about Elneny as a good squad player, right? Mm. You know, he's reliable. He's, you know, and I can see that, but I think what you have to look at is improving the level of your squad players.
Mm.
You know, he can do a job, but can he do the job well enough?
Yeah, and we're in a position as well where we've not got Xhaka in the middle of midfield.
Well, that's another part of left it, yeah. Back.
So our weaknesses in that area are being exposed. But somebody who could move the ball in a similar fashion to Partey, or at least in the same direction, that would be nice. I think that cost Arsenal... I think it affected Arsenal quite a lot, actually, that particular... absentee.
I think so. There was a sort of, you know, in the second half, basically our plan, such as it was to give it to Saka on the right hand side and see what he can do with it. And it was quite, I mean, there was a period, wasn't there, maybe around 75 minutes or so, where the same thing happened about three or four times in a row, where Saka would pick the ball up on the right-hand side. He'd cut inside onto his left foot, holding off the fullback or whoever it was that was going with him. There was a shot, I think. There was a pass for Nketiah. There were a couple of moments, but they're all almost identical. It was like, well, here you go. Try again. Try again. Try again.
And particularly in that last 20 minutes. I mean,
yeah,
it was like he was trying to get the equaliser on his own at times, Saka. You know, had the shot from range, played a really good ball into the box towards Nketiah. He was kind of... I mean, it wouldn't be fair to say he was playing right back because he wasn't really. But he was in that part of the pitch and he was absolutely the root. I think in the first half...
It was quite strange. I'm sorry. I mean, it was quite strange, you know, given how effective he was from that right-hand side, he finished the game on the left.
Yeah, did he?
He spent a lot of time on the left in the final stages. So.
Oh, yeah, that's true. In the very dying minutes, Pepe went over to the right, didn't he?
Yeah, Martinelli was over there too, so...
Yeah, I found that an interesting swap, yeah, when Martinelli went over to that side. But I think in the first half, there was a bit more to be encouraged about. I think when Lacazette was on the pitch, he and Smith Rowe combined relatively well. We had that early chance for Martinelli, didn't we? Very, very early. Another decent opportunity that was well saved. Martinelli, Smith Rowe cut it back. I thought we had our moments in that first half hour. It just became a bit turgid. And like you say, Saka was the route to goal, particularly in that last 20 minutes or so, until Matt Ryan intervened. I've got a question about that, actually.
Go on, yeah.
Not specifically about his assist, but Sammy on Twitter says, what are your thoughts of Matt Ryan? Small sample size, but I liked how commanding he was from crosses. And considering we're going to be the Stoke of the ESL, should we play him as a target man for his effective flick-ons and knockdowns?
Well, we also had a question on the Discord from Elliot Watson, who said, good morning, gents. What do you think about giving Matty Ryan some more game time? With any chance of going far in the league, basically dead, and Leno's going to be the goalie for the Europa League matches, is it best to rest him for the rest of the Premier League and play Ryan instead? Look, there's something... There wasn't a lot to like about us yesterday and our performance, and you know, we came within a whisker of losing our 13th game of the season, which is but the goalkeeper going up for a corner and getting a header which helps lead to a goal, you've got to like that.
Yeah,
it's the first time I can remember for a long time anyway, an Arsenal goalkeeper going and doing something like that.
For an Arsenal fan, he must have absolutely relished it. I mean, I think we had a corner just before and he almost got to that.
Yeah, pre-assist. He's like the goalkeeping Alex Kleb.
Yeah. I mean, he does well to get the flick on and then Ceballos turns it back across goal and Eddie Nketiah does that Eddie Nketiah thing of scoring from, you know, two yards out. Generally, Matt Ryan's game, I mean, I would be in favour of giving him a bit more game time and figuring out, is this a guy we should sign? You know, I don't... massively opposed to that, and I do think that our Premier League campaign, I don't think it's just the events of the past sort of 12 hours that are making me say I don't really care about it massively anymore. I feel like, you know, it from a competitive perspective, the Europa League is kind of where it's at for us.
Yeah, well, I mean, on that basis then you could make the case for a lot of interesting selection decisions, you know?
Yeah. Did I see you making the case? I can't remember if it was you. Somebody making the case for Miguel Aziz to get some game time.
No,
at some
it wasn't
point
me.
Soon.
But like, yeah, why not? Why not?
Yeah,
wouldn't
why
mind
not?
Seeing it. Wouldn't mind seeing it. I mean, we have one here from Hunky Watson who says, morning, lads. Does Lacazette's injury, Aubameyang's malaria, and Nketiah's hopelessness, I think it's a little bit harsh, considering he scored the goal for us, and Balogun's inexperience provide an early opportunity for Martinelli to start up front?
Yeah, I wondered if we might see that yesterday. I have to say, I thought there was a possibility of that. Because, you know, we'd given Lacazette a rest and Pepe could have played off the left. Maybe. I mean, he's not playing badly in the left-sided row either, I think it's worth saying. I think he had a good, busy game yesterday and it always looked like he might make something
Should have
happen.
Scored. Should have scored early on. What do you think?
Yeah, should have scored that probably. There was one in the second half where he had a decent effort as well, sort of slalomed a bit and in the yeah. box and got off a shot at goal, as he so often does. Yeah, I'd be open to that. I'd also be open to seeing Balogun as well. I think, you know, I'm not saying let's start him in every game, but, you know, 20 minutes here and there in the Premier League, having had that opportunity in the Europa League, it feels yeah. like a natural step.
Well, exactly. Start looking to the future, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Here's a question that I saw on the Discord. Now, where is it? Ah, Matt on the Discord. At what point do we accept that offside is subjective? The only reason the rule was introduced in the first place was to stop players gaining advantage by being ahead of the defence. This is best done in real time, and the best we can manage is for the referee linesman to make a subjective but fallible call. Drawing lines and using slow motion and freeze frames actually makes it harder to make such a decision. We could use electron microscopes, but it clearly doesn't help settle whether an advantage was gained. In short, should we just scrap VAR for being completely irrelevant?
Well, I know if I say I would do away with VAR after yesterday, people will say, well, that's because Arsenal had a goal disallowed and another decision didn't go our way. And even, you know, yeah. but I can't begin to explain how much it takes away from the experience of a football match for me, you know?
I completely agree. Yeah.
The best thing about football is when your team scores a goal. It's literally it doesn't matter if it's the first minute or the 91st minute, the reaction is the same. Okay, there's levels, of course, but you score in the first minute, everyone goes mental. There's still 89 minutes to play, but that thing, that putting the ball in the net, is what it is all about, and VAR is taking away from that. It's taking yep. away. I mean, I saw... had a discussion last week on Twitter with a couple of people, and somebody said that in the FA Cup final, they didn't celebrate Aubameyang's goal because they were just convinced that there was going to be some kind of VAR check that would rule it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, how sad is that? I'm not talking about from that person's perspective. I mean, in general, that what a brilliant goal that was. And you've been so traumatized or shell-shocked by the technology that you can't allow yourself to celebrate that moment in the moment because you're afraid it will get ruled out. I mean, yesterday's, okay, by the letter of the law, Saka is offside, but it's absurd. And it could be the rule that needs changing and not VAR. And people say, you know, the problem isn't VAR, it's the implementation of VAR. And that could also be true. But to me, it feels like VAR is being used in the Premier League. And look, maybe fans in other countries have their own issues with it. We just don't hear about it. I don't know. Maybe it's brilliant in Spain, and maybe it's brilliant in Germany, and maybe it's brilliant in France and brilliant in Italy. I'm not sure, though. But our experience of it, you know, is bad. It has detracted from the game. And it feels like they're using VAR to micro-analyze every single incident to try and find a reason to disallow goals, rather than using it as a tool to get more decisions right or to correct this clear and obvious errors. Saka, his toe is not a clear and obvious error. I mean, the fact that they spent an age looking to see if there was an offside for the Fulham penalty rather than saying, well, that's a dive. The video evidence is showing us that while, yes, there was a slight bit of contact from Gabriel on Lamina, it was not the kind of... we're still unable to get our heads around the concept of contact not being punished. Do you know what I mean? People say, oh, well, there was contact. So it's a contact sport. Players run together, they jump, they tussle, all of that kind of stuff. Is every contact a foul or worthy of a penalty? Is what happened with Gabriel yesterday sufficient for a fucking grown man to throw himself through the air like he has been hit from behind by an angry charging bison. No. Those are the things that VAR should be looking at. So what was the original question? Oh, offside and all that. Anyway, my point is, fuck VAR. To kingdom come forever and ever. If somebody could tell me one thing positive that it brings to the game, I'd love to hear it. I'd love to hear it. Because all it does is create delays, bad decisions linger longer. You know what I mean? They kind of fester because they're there. We're watching the replays, we're watching the lines, we're watching the fucking protractor come out, back and forward, back and forward. Is it his toe? What about his hip? Is his hip ahead of the, you know, it's just bullshit. It's bullshit.
I couldn't agree more. And I really strongly dislike what it does to the game, what it does to the emotional experience of the game, you know, what it changes for the supporters, for the players. I think it takes away so much more than it adds.
Yeah.
I think it's been a complete disaster, and I'd love to see it go. I really, really would. I don't think that will happen.
No, neither do I.
Genie bottle,
sure,
etc.
Fucking genies. Anyway, here's a question from Lucy, who's at Lucy Gooner. He says, morning both. My question to you is, has Hector Bellerin's race been run? I can't see him being at the club next season. His performances have dropped off dramatically, and I missed Callum Chambers yesterday.
I think his race is kind of run, I have to say. I think it just feels natural at this point that there should be a parting of the ways. And I don't think he had a great game against Fulham at all. I thought it was telling in some ways that he was one of the players substituted. I think it's probably done for him. And I think it raises an interesting question, as we debated the other day, about, you know, what happens at right back. You know, what do you do with Callum Chambers? What do you do with Cedric? But what do you think about Bellerin?
I felt kind of sad watching him yesterday.
Yeah,
you know, he was the captain, and he didn't have a great game at all. I know he had that chance just before he came off, but I think it's sad, to be honest, because he's grown up at Arsenal and he's a really good guy. And if we bemoan an ownership and an executive that doesn't understand the club or the fans or the institution the way we would want, he does. You know, whether you think he's a good player or not, you can't question that side of his Arsenal experience at all. And I think what's also been lost in maybe the last year or so of frustration with Hector is like what an exciting prospect he was. Like,
oh yeah,
you know, what potential he had. And, you know, it seems really clear that the two injuries he's had, people think of the ACL injury, and I think that's a big one, obviously. But there was an ongoing ankle injury as well that I think has debilitated his physical level to the point that we are where we are right now. Like, the blinding pace is not there. It's not there anymore. And, you know, that was such an exciting part of his game, his ability to get up and down the pitch, you know, at speed, because he could get forward and he could get back. You remember that? Was it against Swansea? Where he sort of raced back from the halfway line and the player went around the goalkeeper, and there was Hector like Billy fucking Wiz.
Roadrunner.
Yeah. So I felt sad, to be honest. I do think the time is right for a parting of the ways. But, like, you know, I don't bear any ill will towards him or anything like that. I think, and I hope, that wherever he goes, he can enjoys football and maybe get his career back on track a little bit. But sometimes, like you say, there is a natural time for a relationship between a player and a club to end. And I think that's where we are with Hector.
Yeah, and it could and should have been last summer, but that's not what Arteta wanted. But, you know, I don't think he's really first choice anymore, and that tells its own story. And there have been times this season where I think he's been harshly criticised, but yesterday was one of those games where I was looking at it and thinking, oof, you know, he's really not at the level he was or that we hoped for him to be. So with a heavy heart, I think it is time for him to get a fresh start. And maybe in a different team, in a different environment, his career, you know, might change, might pick up some speed. We shall see. But yeah, I think we're watching his final Arsenal season.
Yeah.
Are we going back to Super League questions, or are we just...
Yeah, we can do one
if
you want, yeah. Why not?
Well, it's a pressing issue too, but yeah, there's a lot of stuff about it. Let me have a look. If you've got one to hand, go for it.
You have a look. I just wanted to read this one out from the Discord from Gagan J. And it's not really a question. I mean, there were a couple of non-questions. For example, Chifinho says, not really a question. I'm just gutted. My dream was always to see Arsenal win the Champions League. Now that will never happen. Fleds says, how do you both feel this morning? I feel like I've been kicked in the stomach. A restless sleep did not help, and the cold light of day makes this whole thing seem even worse. Is this the death of proper competition? Gagan J says, what's left of the game you fell in love with? You blink and suddenly it's not Rocky gritting his teeth at Anfield or either of the brawls at Old Trafford. It's a field of transient mercenaries advertising the latest training top, gagged by their own PR companies. His toe clearly touches the attacker's toe, has replaced the conversation about whether a foul is a foul. You can't even celebrate a goal now. Gamblers are punished more harshly than actual racists. Intergenerational shareholders are tossed aside and living legends are snubbed from the board. We're mid-table and now this ESL shit, which is actually allowing Rupert Murdoch's company to take the moral high ground. So my question is, what the fuck is left? Which is, you know, as rhetorical a question as there ever can be, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I think it is rhetorical, but I also think in some respects we answered it in part one that, you know, there will still be things about this sport people can engage with, but it's increasingly difficult. It's increasingly difficult. I mean, here's an alternative perspective on the Super League. Ringo Casey on the Discord says, while I'm against the Super League, we have known this was coming, and with Kroenke at the heart of Arsenal, we've seen the human side of football being slowly stripped away to a purely financial venture for many owners. Is this just inevitability and the most sensible decision for a company that is losing status and money?
Yeah, strip the emotion out of it and you can see why. And I think it is an inevitability.
Was there another path? Something I've been thinking about since yesterday. You know, we associate this with Kroenke, and I think that's absolutely right. But is it realistic or plausible that Arsenal could genuinely be in the modern Premier League in a position where they weren't part of this?
Do you mean in terms of the ownership structure that, like...
I just mean, like, you know, it's tempting to think if we had... I think sometimes because our owner is bad, we maybe make the mistake of slightly venerating the previous ownership model a bit too much. And I don't know for sure we wouldn't have gone down this path. That this is just the kind of inevitable capitalist swell of football happening.
I think so. When you're a club of the stature of Arsenal, you become a target, you know, for these kind of owners. I don't know if there was a different path. Once you start getting into the kind of money that I mean, clearly,
all these big clubs have the same kinds of owners, right? Like, all owned by.
Yeah, I mean, sort of. You know, there's a couple of different ones, though, aren't there? I mean, they're the franchise owners, like the American owners that we have and Liverpool have. Then there's the oligarch owners like Chelsea and Man City. Obviously, Man United in there as well.
I should say none of them have their kind of traditional ownership, you know, structure or person in place.
No.
But
I mean, it's just impossible to resist.
Yeah.
Maybe with hindsight, you could look back and say, well, there are certain things that we should and should not allow when it comes to the ownership of a football club.
Yeah. I mean, don't you think that the Premier League bear a lot of responsibility for this, in terms of, and the football authorities, and maybe even the government to an extent, in terms of never kind of mitigating against these clubs just becoming purely commercial enterprises?
Yeah.
Again, it's difficult. I mean, yes, in theory, that would be nice, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a... I suppose the thing that you would say about sport is that the more level the playing field, the better it is for the competition, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of impossible. And then you just get levels of that whereby, you know, the big clubs generate the most income. You think of what Man United did. You know, when they became a financial behemoth in the 90s, they were the first club to see the potential for, you know, worldwide branding and marketing and all of that kind of stuff, you know? But that was predicated on their own success and their own stature as a football club down the years. Like, Man United could have had the best marketers in the world, but if they didn't have Alex Ferguson as manager...
Sure.
Wouldn't have made it any difference.
David,
you know?
Beckham. Yeah.
So, you know, the idea that everything could be hunky-dory and fair play for everybody, it's a lovely socialist ideal, but it's not the reality in which football and the world exists.
No. I don't think so either. And obviously... You know, if you look at like the German model, for example, that's very different because you've got kind of 51% fan ownership. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see a couple of German teams turning up in this. Dortmund, I understand, have now said they won't be doing it.
They won't. But, well, yeah. Bayern, I'm sure, will have to.
You'd think.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just an interesting something I've been thinking about, you know. How were there points in the road at which this course could have been averted? And my sort of overriding feeling is probably not. Probably inevitably Arsenal was going to get bought up by one of several types of owners. And probably they were going to look to maximise their investment by guaranteeing revenue in this kind of fashion.
Yeah.
It is sort of the curse of being a big, successful, theoretically successful club in some ways.
I don't think I've got anything else. I like this one from at Skipper AFC. Who do you think Arsenal select with the European Super League 2022 number one overall draft pick after finishing 10th as a founding father? there was also a question on the Discord from, let me find it here, Gregors, who says, is there the possibility that given we couldn't get relegated in this fuck fair, that Kroenke would just sell all our best players for money again, as it will make no tangible difference? I don't know what the rules are about transfers and stuff like that. Are there any new regulations?
They're talking about some sort of FFP equivalent, which will be interesting. I think, I mean, here's the thing. I may be proven wrong on this. I hope I'm right. I don't think this is about that money that comes into the club, you know, going straight in Stan's pocket. I think it's about increasing the value of his investment and having those kinds of guaranteed revenues. Absolutely does that. I mean, someone said to me yesterday, who's quite well connected at Arsenal, said he will be weeping tears of joy. He won't believe his luck. And
but it's not luck. It's design. This is not luck. This
it's
is
luck,
something-
I think, to pull it off, given what Arsenal have produced in the last 5 years or whatever of competition. They've won a couple of FA Cups, but I think given his investment levels as compared to some of the other owners, as compared to, you know, the Chelsea's or the Man City's, I think it's panned out extremely well for him.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
And this might sound massively cynical. How many home games a season do you see Arsenal playing in LA?
I saw a brilliant tweet, and I forget who it was now, but it was pointing out how many of these Super League clubs have kind of amorphous names. You know, Arsenal, Inter, Real, Bayern. Like, it's very easy to divorce City, United. It's very easy to kind of divorce them from their geographic location.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very interesting observation, the idea that there is something franchisable about many of these teams.
Yeah.
I don't know how soon that would happen, but I think it starts to become a very real possibility, especially if...
I mean, it sounds like it's beyond the pale, doesn't it? But then what have we just spent most of this podcast discussing? We're well beyond the pale already. So anything on top of this can't be of any surprise to anyone.
I think that actually seems highly plausible. Highly plausible.
When your owner's got a $6 billion stadium in LA, that's, you know, it's got to get paid.
You've got to pay for it somehow. And again, if you're going to fill that with games, maybe better games between so-called European giants than your sort of standard Premier League fare.
Yeah, I mean, don't tell me that Arsenal Real Madrid or Arsenal Barcelona wouldn't sell out in LA.
I mean, especially with those Spanish clubs. Yeah, I mean, it would be huge.
You know, we had games on the US tour.
Of course.
Didn't quite sell out, but I mean, the one in DC, I think there was... very big crowd in a very big stadium there.
Yeah, I think that's probably, again, something that's maybe something that is an inevitability and that we have to start coming to... Well, we have to accept that that's a real risk, that that's going to happen. And listen, Arsenal fans will stand up and make their voice heard as far as they can and speak out. I'm sure about that. I just don't have a lot of optimism for it. I really don't. And I'm not saying that to kind of poo-poo anybody's efforts. I just think they've absolutely shown us what they think of us. So it's quite unlikely we can change it. And frankly, in terms of like, well, I'm not going to renew my season ticket or I'm not going to buy the rep shirt, whatever it is, this deal means they probably don't need your money on that.
And
so
on
our
that,
leverage
yeah.
is...
Yeah. Yeah. On that depressing note, I think we should leave it there. I get the podcast out for people.
Sorry it's not more cheerful. And sorry if we didn't reflect. I know there are some fans who have seen them, who think, this is great. I'm looking forward to it. I'll enjoy the games. And if that's your perspective, you are entitled to it. But it's just not how I feel in the light of the news.
No, me neither. Me neither. And all we can do is, you know, try. It's difficult. When something like this, something of this magnitude happens, to make all the points you want to make in a really concise way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because there's a lot of just us bouncing this back and forth off one another to try and come to terms with it ourselves. So apologies if it's been a bit all over the place. But I think that's just the nature of something of this scale, as you try and come to understand it and think about all the various implications of it. But you know, I think what we've done is provide you with an honest representation of what we're feeling and what our concerns are. And, you know, it might change down the line, or certainly, you know, as more information comes to pass, we'll either, I don't know how it'll be. All we can do is react with honesty the way that we did today. So hopefully, hopefully you enjoyed the show as much as possible, given the circumstances. And we're
still figuring it out as well. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like,
that's the point I was trying to make. Yeah.
It's difficult. Yeah. You know, it's a lot to process, a lot to take in. And it's very bound up with emotion. So it's not straightforward to talk about it.
No.
But as I said, this won't be the last conversation we have.
No, I'm sure it won't. But look, as ever, folks, thank you so much for being here and for listening and subscribing and all the rest. We really do appreciate it. We are kind of all in this together as Arsenal fans. So let's see what happens over the coming days and weeks and everything else. And of course, we'll keep you up to date here on the podcast and on the site as well. But we'll leave it there for now. We'll catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.